Doubt means it's the fifth hindrance and hardly ever gets mentioned. That is where we're not quite sure what we're supposed to be doing, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. Is this the most skillful way of doing things? And it is to overcome that doubt that you have to give so many talks and explanations of what meditation is. And the way the Buddha taught, he explained those hindrances as you have perplexity, you're confused about what's a wholesome state, what's an unwholesome state, what is supposed to be happening, what is good, what is going to take you into deep meditation and nirvana, and what's going to go in the opposite direction. And unfortunately, because there were so many teachers, so many methods, so much stuff, it does become quite confusing. And you know, sometimes I roll my eyes when I hear some teachers say, oh no, if you get happy in meditation, that you'll get attached. So first of all, please, there should be no confusion there at all. If you do get happy in meditation, it's called the development of piti sukha. It is part of the path. It's supposed to happen. In fact, you can't get enlightened or jhanas or anything without it. So it is supposed to happen. So don't ever be confused if you start to get joy and happiness in the meditation. And to give that little piece of advice, more power, you know, because the teachers say all sorts of different things. You have to quote the word of the Buddha, the final authority, where he said many, many times, the happiness in meditation, na bayita bang, bahuri kata bang, ase witta bang, bawaita bang. And I'm saying it in Pali just to impress you that I know what I'm talking about. Because sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahmi just talks about two bad bricks that open the door of your heart. All very nice. But what's that got to do with the word of the Buddha? Okay, so what that means in English, and it's not just one place, it's many, many places in the teachings of the Buddha, in the suttas. It means that happiness, which comes up in meditation, should not be feared. It's not something which is an obstacle. Don't be afraid of it. Instead, he said, follow it. Literally make much of it. Now develop it, and develop it. Those three things. So when you do have the happiness in meditation, don't think, oh, something is going wrong. This is a danger. I should be afraid of this, like a snake coming into your room. No, this is a wonderful thing. So welcome it, develop it. So that's the first one. And the second one, you just have to look at, say, the Anapanasati Sutta, the meditation on the breath. Stages 5 and 6 of the 16 stages. As you're breathing, you develop piti. As you're breathing, you develop sukha. This is the happiness and the bliss. This is what you are supposed to develop. And that's in the Anapanasati Sutta, 118 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And then we go to things like one of my favorite suttas, the Dhammacaya Sutta, which I happen to mention every retreat just to give this teaching some force. When King Prasenadi went to visit the Buddha just before the king was about to pass away, and he went into the Buddha's hut and started kissing the Buddha's feet, and the king said, you're supposed to be a king, stop it. Imagine if Queen Elizabeth came into my room. That would be quite inappropriate. So the king was kissing the Buddha. He said, what are you doing this for? He said, just I love you, all your teachings, and I love this monastery. And the Buddha started asking, why do you love this monastery, the famous Jetavana, the Jeta Grove monastery, just outside of Sarvati? And that's when the king said, because every time I come into this monastery, unlike other monasteries, the monks are always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes! That is what's supposed to happen when your meditation starts to take off. You're supposed to be happy. And that's a little snapshot of the Buddha telling the king, yes, when happiness comes, don't be afraid of it. It's wholesome. Go for it. And the last of my store of sutta quotes is from the Pasadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. You can look it up for yourself. Get the tape, get the books out, and you can look it up for yourself. Where the Buddha said, if anyone, he's actually referring to people of other sects, other religions. He never expected other Buddhist monks to say this. He said, if anyone says, if you get happy in meditation, you get attached to it, you should say, yes, we will get attached to it. And the Buddha said, and there's four results of getting attached to the bliss of meditation. And the word attached, the way I translate it here, and it's a very good translation, the word is anuyoga. Now, yoga is like, we have the English word yoke. It literally means the two cows or bulls tied together. Now, anu means together. And it literally means tying together, which is another good word for attachment. So he said, if you get anuyogad to the bliss of meditation, if you get tied to it, attached to it, you can only expect one of four results. The only things which can happen to you, one of the four. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. The four stages of enlightenment. So I'm impressing that. So if you start to get happy in meditation, please don't think there's something going wrong. Please think, uh-oh, I'm going to get attached, so I better get rid of this happiness straight away. No, you deserve it, it's part of the path, and it's important. Because the more happiness comes in meditation, the more you want to meditate, the longer you sit, the deeper you go, and also you start getting incredible insights from the happy meditations. And that's why you see people in this retreat, in Ajahn Brahm's retreat, they start smiling more. They're happier than some other retreats where people are just so afraid of the teacher. So that's number one. Don't be afraid. And don't be confused about the wholesome state of happiness which comes in the meditation. And number two, don't be confused about the wholesome state of things disappearing in meditation. Again, this is what is supposed to happen. The five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, are supposed to disappear. You notice as far as insight goes, you just ask, you know, I was just talking to one of the doctors here in the interview yesterday. Just the nature of the mind. You know, what is this so-called sixth sense? If you look at Greek philosophy, Aristotle always had six senses. This is from what's supposed to be the source of Western philosophy. And somewhere along the line, we dropped that sixth sense of the mind. So now we've only got five. You know, the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching. And somehow this mind business has always caused great confusion to science. And always thinking that the mind is some byproduct of the brain. And I just, someone showed me a very interesting video which I recommend to you on TEDx on the internet is a group of lectures sponsored by I don't know who, which is supposed to be provocative, challenging, giving new ideas. And one of those TEDx videos was of the Cambridge scientist called Rupert Sheldrake, who got thrown out of Cambridge for being too radical. But now, when people get thrown out of places, I like them. You know, because they're actually creating good ideas. They're challenging the status quo. And one of his statements there, which is, you know, you could, I'm right behind this, you have to distinguish between scientific method and scientific dogma. Because a lot of times people support science, but science has got dogmatic. But keep the method, which is always challenging, evidence-based. And for the doctor I was talking to, I mentioned that one of his statements on this TEDx channel was that, oh, I'm going straight away off the beaten track here about hindrances, but I get passionate about such things, so please indulge me. For those of you who did your high school physics, you know, the law of gravity, You know, this Newton's law, nothing special, just the attraction between two objects is the product of their masses divided by the square of the distance apart, times a universal gravitational constant called Big G. And good old Mr. Sheldrake, he said, why should it be a constant? The scientific method is to challenge everything. So he did some research, because there are government agencies in most developed countries which actually just measure these things, as a matter of course. And the evidence is there. Big G changes. It is not a constant. And of course, when I heard that, my memory went back about 45 years ago, to when I was at Cambridge and went to one of the most inspiring lectures by Professor Fred Hoyle, who was a real scientist. He also got kicked out of Cambridge eventually. You know, he had the chair which Sir Stephen Hawking has now, for being too radical. And he too, he went up there, and I remember him saying, why should this universal gravitational constant be constant? Why doesn't it change? Let's open up that possibility. That is science. Always ready to challenge. So now we go back to the main thing. How come we lost our mind? Literally. And that's what, again, Rupert Sheldrake was saying, no, you have to bring this consciousness business into science. The mind is not part of the brain. And that's really important. So how can we actually prove that? And I've been saying, as meditators, you can prove it for yourself. This is the experiment. Meditation. Calm the mind down. Calm everything down until sight vanishes, hearing vanishes, smell, taste, touch, it all goes. And you're not unconscious. You are aware. And actually, surprisingly, immensely aware. You know, many people talk about mindfulness, so much so this mindfulness-based this and mindfulness-based therapy and mindfulness-based cooking and mindfulness-based going to the toilet. I don't know if it's mindfulness-based cooking yet, but it will come. And they haven't got a clue what mindfulness means. And I remember going to a psychology conference and they gave a definition of mindfulness. You guys don't know what you're talking about. Because mindfulness, you experience this. The ordinary mindfulness they're talking about is just so weak. But eventually, when you meditate, your mindfulness gets incredibly strong and powerful. And it is like you are waking up. You know what it's like when you first wake up in the morning, maybe in China, and go, oh, what time is it? Where am I? And until you got your first cup of tea or coffee, you don't know really where you are. Now, you know that's low mindfulness. You've all experienced that. You know sometimes, yeah, you know, you're sort of, the mindfulness you have now. There are other times when you're super aware. Sometimes you don't know why it is, but you're just right there in this moment and everything is bright, everything is clear. And that is just most people's experience of the different grades of mindfulness. But when you meditate, that really takes off. Which is why that I developed the word of power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. And I've already mentioned a few cases of superpower mindfulness. That's when you go outside and just the sky is absolutely beautiful. It's gorgeous. I mean, you can see so many more colours in the sky. And whatever colour it is, even grey, if it's like a cloudy day, that grey is rich and deep and powerful. You are aware. And the food you put in your mouth is like a taste explosion. And that's just a glass of water. You know, let alone you have some curry or some congee or whatever. And everything is just so powerful. You really are awake and aware. And this is sometimes what happens. So when you're trying to find out what this mind actually is, you know, which confuses so many people, all the five senses are gone. And the mind is the only thing which is left. And you're fully aware. You are not in some trance. That's the other confusion people say. They say, oh, you know, if you're in jhanas, you don't know what's going on at all. You're not mindful. You are mindful. Super mindfulness. And if anyone doubts that, you can just look at the fourth jhana. That's the purity of mindfulness and equanimity. So says the Buddha. It's purity. It's height. So, when things disappear, They are meant to disappear. Don't have any confusion or doubt. Oh, what's going on? My hands are vanishing. What's going on? I can't feel the body. What's going on? I don't know what time it is. That is supposed to happen. Don't be confused about that. Let it happen. When sort of the hands disappeared, I think, ah, my hands are disappearing. I better find them again. This is supposed to happen. So let things vanish. Yes, it's a bit afraid at first because you're going to new areas where you haven't been before. But this is what's supposed to happen. If you're going to get insight, wisdom, you don't get wisdom by visiting the same old place everyone else goes. You've got to go to new areas, interesting areas, where you find truths which other people haven't seen because they haven't been there. So you go to the place where the whole body and the five senses vanishes. And then you see the beautiful light come in the mind. And I said, don't doubt that. It's supposed to happen. And it's very difficult to describe, which is why some people get, is this the nimitta? Is this not the nimitta? Rule of thumb, 99% sure. If you think it is, it is. And sometimes I wonder, why it is that people these days, you know, they doubt. You know, things like achieving a nimitta, because of your lack of self-esteem. You know, you've always been brought up thinking you're not good enough. In Singapore, unless you're straight A's, not even straight A's, straight A pluses, then you're not good enough. Unless you're a supermodel, you're not pretty enough as a girl. Unless you're just like strong and hot like some Brad Pitt, you're not good enough as a guy. You just ask your wife. You're not good. Ask your husband. And it's been a whole life. You go to work and you're never good enough. And that lack of self-esteem means that you get something which is beautiful, like you never think, no, I can't get nimitta. It's not me. Maybe Ajahn Brahm, he was born a monk. Well, not me. But yes, you're getting these things. So don't be confused and don't doubt when it happens. You're throwing away this beautiful gift. It can't be me. I can't get these things. Yes, you can, as Obama used to say. So just let it happen and enjoy it. And when it gets blissed out, the other thing which starts to disappear, all these things, if it disappears, great. You're always on the right path. If it's more things come to you, if it's attainments, those are attachments. When things disappear, that's the path to enlightenment. So eventually, just the other thing which disappears is your ability to control things. And that's the most scary thing of all, when you're totally out of control. And at the last retreat I gave somewhere, somebody said they had this vision of, I know it was actually a dream after one of my talks. They were driving along in their car, they were at the driving wheel, and they went over a cliff and went right down, going faster and faster. And there was a bend at the very end. And they just remembered Ajahn Brahm, just let go. And they let go of the steering wheel and they went down and went perfectly around the bend into safety. Yes, that's how it works. You like going over a cliff sometimes, you think, I'm out of control, things are going to go wrong. They don't go wrong, guaranteed. Dania, how many people have died in this Jhana Grove retreat center since I've been teaching? Has anyone died? How many people have gone crazy? And this is, was it 5 years now? Four years. Perfect track record. So you are not going to spoil it. You are perfectly safe. If in meditation it feels like you're going over a cliff, over a precipice, go! You'll be perfectly okay. Don't doubt. Because if they have that doubt, you start interfering with the beautiful process and it all fails. I know what happens when you fall over that cliff, and it's worth it. It's brilliant. Okay, I always have to be honest, because I'm a monk. There is a danger. You've heard me say this before. There is a danger if you go over those cliffs and get into jhana many times. And that danger is, you might lose your hair. That's the only danger. Other than that, you're fine. But it's really worth it because you're having a great time. So don't have any doubt at all. And the next thing, just about doubt, it was a simile which I developed, which was, again, you try and get some experiences, you know, from your life, something which people will understand. And that was the experience when I was a student. I used to spend many vacations in Scotland, just walking through the mountains in the far north in solitude. I love solitude, even when I was a student. And one day, I went with the local warden of the youth hostel, who was a local boy. He should have known better. We went to walk up one of the mountains. It was a beautiful day. When we got to the top of one of the mountains, you know, I was fit and healthy in those days. I said, let's go to the next mountain over there. He said, no, one mountain's enough for me. You go by yourself. In the mountains, you never should go by yourself. And that he told me that. He should have known better. He went back to the hospital. I went up to the next mountain. By the time I got close to the summit of the next mountain, some clouds had come in from nowhere and descended more quick than I could ever imagine. And I was covered in mist. But, you know your direction, you know which way to go. So I turned around and said, well, waste of time going to the summit. I'm not going to see anything anyway. I turned around and went back the way I came. So I thought. But actually, I checked later on, and I went totally. It was not sort of, it was actually almost 180 degrees opposite direction I thought I was going in. It's very scary. In a mist, when you can't see, you have no sense of direction whatsoever. And I knew that because as I was walking, just there in front of me, I could see down a precipice. We went right down to the very, maybe a couple of hundred of meters. It was the only cliff in the area. And I was just about to walk over it. I was just one step away from death. And it was certain death. It was a long way down. So that scared me. And I thought, I'm lost. And I did hear that in those mountains, there was a case of about three English people who had been lost for about 4 or 5 days. Without food, without water, freezing, wandering around. And the locals were just so impressed that they made it. They're really tough guys. But I thought this was really dangerous. And so I thought, how can I get out of this? Because I didn't know which way to go. And I chose a very simple method. I know that streams go downhill. I found a little stream and followed it. Because I knew that would take me down. It wouldn't take me in circles. It would take me down and down and down. And soon you'll get down enough. You go below the clouds where you could see. And that's exactly what happened. Followed it down, 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 and then I was below the clouds and I could get my directions and see the way to get home. And I use that as a simile for meditation. When you first start meditating, or you've been meditating a while, you don't know which way to go. Should I do insight? Should I do vipassana? Should I do this? Should I do that? How should I meditate? Should I follow this method or that method? What should I do? It's a waste of time going and ask somebody because they'll say their method, which is not quite the same as what you heard before. It just adds more confusion. So what you do, you use that stream method in the mist. As long as it's going in the right direction, you know it must be okay. If you're becoming more peaceful, more happy, more relaxed, it must be the right direction. If you're getting more tense, more angry, more suffering. You're going in the wrong direction, baby. Stop it. Turn around and go to some other place. So that's how you know whether you're going in the right direction. And if you don't know yourself, ask the people you live with. And if they say after retreat, well, you're much worse than when you left. You've got the wrong direction. And people have told me that after some retreats. You know, they're more angry. This is their relations. Not my retreats. My retreats, you're always more happy. In some retreats. That's obviously you're doing the wrong thing. It has to be going in the right direction. So they should overcome doubt. So you actually know what's going on. Let things be happy. Let things disappear. let things become out of control. Let it go. That's what letting be is. And it's safe. You go in the right direction, feel much more relaxed, much happier. Even just the first piece of advice, simple advice like rest more. Do you feel happier? More relaxed? You're going in the right direction. Carry on. So that's like doubt. Obviously, as you have more experience, that is the best way to overcome the hindrance of doubt, because after a while you realize, yes, this is working. Yes, this is what's happening. Yeah, you know, I am actually experiencing this beautiful peace and happiness of meditation. The stress levels are going down. I'm more aware. Everything is more beautiful. My cloudy mind is becoming clearer. You know, I can sit for longer periods without effort. This is what is supposed to happen. So the experience is teaching you, yes, this is the right path. And eventually, obviously, when you get into those deep meditations, wow, these are the biggest things which have ever happened to you in your life. And I don't say that easily. They are the biggest things. And this is, wow, this is why the Buddha called these meditations Uttari Manusadhamma, which means above ordinary human experience. What we say in the monastery, the stuff of aliens, extraterrestrials. It's not a good translation, but you know, Uttari means above or extra. Manusa means, you know, terrestrial beings, and Dhammas. So it's like basically E.T. Dhamma. That's not what it means. We just play around with translating Pali sometimes. So this is great stuff, big stuff, and you experience this. So this is actually where you understand. But you also understand the path of these things, because after a while the other thing which should be very careful of, the hindrance of wanting and expecting. Because my big problem as a teacher is when I start to talk about these amazing states, which is good to tell you about, because some of you experience them and wonder what the heck's going on. I'll always remember when I gave a retreat in Penang many years ago, they asked me to do some counseling for this middle-aged lady who was supposed to be crazy. And no other counselor could help her. So it's one of those cases of, oh, here we go again, and what's going on? The last resort, Ajahn Brahm. And of course, you come in, she comes into the room, then we just let her talk. And I was amazed, it was one of those wonderful experiences, because when I asked her what happened, she started saying all these things about she was sitting down, her body disappeared, she saw this incredible, wonderful light, she fell into the light, she was really incredible bliss, but she didn't know what was going on, she wasn't there. And I just smiled and said, "Madam, you just had a jhana." And then I said a few other things about what she had experienced. She said, "Yes, that's right. How did you know?" You know, because, you know, you're an expert on these things, so I could tell her. And she wasn't crazy at all, but she had such an extraordinary, powerful experience. No one else understood what it was. And because of that, she thought she'd gone mad. And this is one of the reasons I teach these things. So at least you know that these are going to happen. And when it does happen, you know you haven't gone crazy. You're not afraid. You allow it to happen. But the downside of that is that people have expectations. They say, "I've already been here for two days and I haven't got a nimitta yet. Ajahn Brahm, help." Now this is, again, Singaporean and Malaysian and Australian sort of habits. We're such high achievers. We want so much. You've done so well in your life, and now, okay, I've got my life in. I've got a nice wife. I've got a nice kids. I've got a good job. That's all settled. Now I'm going to go for my spiritual path. You know, to get the AAA pluses, jhanas. Please, after a while, you realize you have no doubt left that that is counterproductive. These are all states of stillness. It's what happens when you don't want things. And you understand why the first hindrance is one of the most powerful and obstructive. Wanting, desire, craving for things. Because every time you want something else, You're not here where you are. You're out there on some fantasy. And whatever you imagine jhana to be, is something different. That's saying of the Buddha in the Sapavisa Sutta. Whatever you imagine it to be, it's not that at all. It's much better and more profound. Which is why, when we want something, we're going in the wrong direction. So to get these things, you have to let go of all wanting and be perfectly still. And that also includes not expecting anything. Which is why I gave that little, very important, profound teaching of the two types of waiting. Waiting in the future is expecting something to happen. You know, waiting for the bell to go. How many, well, you don't have this in this retreat. In some retreats I used to go on, you used to have like 50 minutes or 1 hour sit. And after the 1 hour, bang, you could get up and go. But you weren't allowed to get up before the gong. Have you been on those retreats? It's like going to school again. And some meditation was so peaceful, so beautiful. I was getting really happy and high, and then bang. Oh, I hated that teacher. I was about to get enlightened and you bang your blooming gong. And other times, oh, I'm hurting, I want to go to the toilet, my back is killing me, my leg is killing me, and he still wouldn't ring the gong. He started to fantasize that maybe the clock has stopped, maybe the batteries have run out, maybe it's 2 hours already, not the 50. And sometimes the meditation would go on for far too long. And so the expecting the gong was the cause of suffering. So this is why we don't have any gongs anymore. No expectations, no waiting for something to happen. Instead, we wait right here in this moment. This is where it all happens, right now. Not in the next moment, not tomorrow, right now. So when you don't have any desire, that's the other hindrance. And it's not just desire for food, that's easy to see. It's not just desire for comfort, to get rid of pains in the body. It's desire to get some of these spiritual attainments. That is your biggest hindrance. Because you've been explained what these are, they are beautiful. And some of you think, oh, I've got to go back home and tell other people why I spent my holidays, 9 days, sitting in a meditation retreat, eating only 2 meals a day, while all your friends have gone to London or Paris and dined in 5-star restaurants and gone to nightclubs and seen this amazing stuff and gone shopping. If you want to go shopping, we've got a few books on sale, I'll stand here. That's the only shopping we've got here in this jhana grove. And afterwards they say, what did you spend all that money for, just going on a retreat and sitting on your backside for 9 days? You're dumb. So you think, I've got to have something to show for this. But please don't do that. Because when you want something, you're missing out on what's already here. When you want something, you're looking somewhere else. Which is why the wanting is the biggest of the hindrances. This is one of the reasons, for 2 or 3 years as a monk, my whole meditation was as a mantra, no desire. No desire. No desire. That's all I did for 2 or 3 years. Just, that was my main thing, make sure that no desire came up in my mind. And it's incredible how powerful that was. You could sit for hours and hours and hours, just sitting there, no desire. No thoughts would come up in the mind, because thought is the language of desire. Just sitting there, not desiring anything, not wanting anything. Not wanting to watch the breath, not wanting jhanas, nothing. Because you didn't want anything, you got incredibly peaceful and still. Remember, wanting is the wind which makes the waves on your mind. So when you don't want anything, the mind gets incredibly still and peaceful. I was just doing all that time, making sure that first hindrance of wanting was overcome. Trouble is that sometimes you get so close to the nimitta comes. You've done excellent, and the very last nimitta, okay, what? So please don't spoil it. So many people asked me, said, yeah, I've meditated, I've got this delightful breath, the limiter's here, now what do I do? Ah, you don't do anything. You got so far, carry on doing nothing. That's how you've got to the limiter. That's how you go further. Exactly the same method, just no desire, not wanting anything, just being here. Then it just happens. And the next hindrance, again, is so powerful, the ill will. And people think ill will just means getting angry at the person who had the last banana today and didn't leave you any. It's not the first time the greedy bitches, they always pitch all the bananas, blah, 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 blah. That's easy to overcome. The real anger or ill will is to yourself or to your stage of meditation. It's incredible how many people have ill will towards themselves. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I should know better than this. And I should, yes, 2 or 3 days, but I should be getting up earlier. Or I got up too early this morning. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I ate too much. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And I snore when I meditate. Stupid, stupid. Don't keep hitting your head. It hurts. So never have ill will towards yourself. Have this beautiful loving kindness towards yourself. You open the door of your heart to your stupid body and your stupid mind. Stupid mind, the door of my heart's open to you. There's absolutely acceptance, no desire, letting things be, not trying to get any better. You are good enough. You don't have to strive to go to the next level. You're already good enough. So this beautiful loving kindness towards yourself. During the meditation, the door of my heart's open to me, even if I'm fast asleep in meditation. That is stopping the hindrances. Or to your meditation object. I've been meditating for 8-9 days here, because some of you came early, and I'm still at just about, I'm just managing to get present moment awareness. And all these other people have only just come 2 days and are already in jhanas. Why is that? It's because sometimes people have ill will towards the meditation object. They want to get deeper. I don't want to be in beautiful breath. I want to be in limitta. I don't want to be in limitta. I want to be in jhana. That's ill will towards where you are, which means you want to go somewhere else. So please never have ill will to whatever stage of meditation you are in right now, however basic. Have this beautiful loving kindness. Sloth and torpor, the door of my heart's open to you. Restless mind, fantasies, psychotic plans, the door of my heart is fully open to you. And that stops some of the biggest of problems. One of the greatest similes of the Buddha, which I mention so many times, and it's in opening the door of your heart. If nothing else works, please remember this one, and that is the demon, the monster in the emperor's palace. You all know that one. Monster came into an emperor's palace when the emperor was away. Stinky, frightening, gross. And all the ministers and guards said, get out of here, you don't belong. And that just made him more gross and stinky. By the time the emperor came back, he was literally monstrous. I suppose all monsters are monstrous, but this is super monstrous. Huge, really stinky. And the simile I came up with, even the maggots crawling over his skin had to throw up and be sick. They vomited, they couldn't even take the stench, let alone human beings. Is quite evocative. I'm really quite proud of that sort of making maggots from it. And the emperor knew exactly what to do. That's why he's the emperor. He said, welcome, monster. Thank you so much for coming to visit. Has anyone got you any conjure yet? And those few kind words, the monster grew smaller, less stinky, less of a problem. That's how you deal with problems in meditation. You don't say, you've got some stupid thought, get out of here, you don't belong. You're not sort of going crazy and saying, no, I don't want to be crazy. You say, welcome, craziness, thank you for coming to visit me. Oh, it's been such a long time since I've been crazy. Thank you. And when you do, when you do things like that, you welcome these things. They always get smaller, less of a problem. So that is one of the most effective ways to overcome barriers in meditation. Welcome. Thank you for visiting me. Which means you're not having ill will, you're not trying to go anywhere. And that's exactly what I did when I had, again, the next hindrance of real restlessness. Because sometimes your mind is just all over the place, thinking about so many things, three things at the same time it seems, and all totally different. And how do you deal with that? And I like telling the story. 4 years as a monk I was, and I found this most beautiful place. I was 5 years as a monk. Even though I wasn't with my teacher Ajahn Chah, I was in the next best thing, in a chah plantation, in a tea plantation in the north of Thailand. As much tea as you could drink. This was Ang Mo heaven. Ang Mo means white monk, or actually red hair. But anyway, so there I was, at a beautiful monastery with caves. I love caves. And there was a bat cave. And I must say, because there's lots of bats in the cave, you know, they always, when they fly out, that's when they do their business. Because when they hang upside down, you can't poo when you're hanging upside down. So they have to wait till they fly. You try it. And so just outside the cave, it was just incredibly rich soil. And I always remember this papaya tree outside. And that's the most delicious papaya I've ever, ever eaten in my whole life. Nothing ever matched that. And that's actually where I got that simile from, you know, about treading in the dog poo, planting it under your mango tree, and it's really sweeter, because I actually did that. It wasn't dog poo, it was bat poo. And the most delicious papaya you could ever imagine. Thank you, bats. But anyway, I was in this, and after about 3 or 4 weeks, because I was by myself, nothing to do but meditate all day, I started getting restless. Now, I know what it's like when the thoughts, they take over your mind, you can't stop them. And it would be okay if there are thoughts about the high dumb, about the meaning of dependent origination or something useful. But you know what, what I was thinking about? Old girlfriends. I wonder where she is now. Sex. Maybe I'm still young enough. Maybe still someone might have me. Romance. And all those thoughts. But I was a monk. Stop it. And I loved being a monk. I always did. But these thoughts kept coming into your mind. What I called unmonkish thoughts. And the more I tried to stop them, the more they came in. And it was driving me crazy. And the thing was, I never had anyone to talk to because I was in solitude by myself. And so one day it got so bad, I remember this. And the only thing I could do was, there was a big Buddha statue in the hall, and I bowed to that and I just said, help. I was really going crazy. And then the idea came to me. That's not supernatural, but just sometimes when you ask someone else, you can get an answer for yourself. And the answer came, why don't I do a deal? If you really have to think about all those unmonkish thoughts, I was going to give myself a time, 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon. I could have my thinking anything goes, and I wouldn't try and stop it at all. Even the weirdest sexual fantasies, I'll accept you from 3 to 4. The rest of the day, you behave. I think fair enough, you know, just make a deal. Of course, it never worked as I expected it. Until 3 o'clock, the mind was still as crazy as ever, going all over the place, thinking about this girl, that girl, ooh, goodness knows what else. And by the time I got to 3 o'clock, you know what it's like when you're restless, you get so exhausted and tired. So at 3 o'clock, I went up to my room, I leaned against the wall, put my feet out, because they were aching. I said, okay, now I'm not going to fight you anymore. Whatever thought comes into the mind, the weirdest sexual fantasy, girlfriend, sex, anything, come in. And for the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one, and it was so peaceful, the calmest moments, the calmest hour I'd had in months. That really shook me. I was trying to fight those thoughts out, and they just kept growing stronger when I said, okay, you can come in, do whatever you want. And I was so calm and peaceful, and there's not a thought came into my mind for an hour. You understand why? I did after that experience. When I was trying to stop those thoughts, I was feeding them, I was giving them energy. But as soon as I said, oh, let go, the door of my heart's open to you, any old thought can come in, whatever it is, come. Nothing came. That is how you break that hindrance. But if you say, okay, open the door of heart, whatever thought comes in, and then you say, it doesn't work, thoughts keep coming in, you haven't let go. What you've done is, I'm letting go as long as things stop. You have to fully let go. And that's what I did, out of desperation. And then things stop, become very peaceful and calm. So a lot of the thoughts come because, again, you're not happy. I say, happy, any thought, whatever comes, I'm happy. And then they didn't come anymore. They stopped. So you find out that this beautiful loving kindness, this letting go, this just overcomes the hindrance of restlessness. So whenever you're restless in this retreat, please let yourself be restless. Don't fight it. You'll only feed it. And just say, okay, I'm going to sit down and be totally restless. And you find you can't. Because what it is, the deeper understanding of this, is a simile. I gave this a couple of days ago in Malaysia in the retreat over in Genting. And it's a simile of the people being invited out for coffee. So someone gives you a call on your cell phone. They say, would you like to come out for a cup of coffee? Say, okay. And then they continue on by saying, and we will go to Starbucks. We will not go to Gloria Jean's or Dome or any place you like. We will go to Starbucks because that's where I want to go. And you will have a latte. None of your healthy stuff, because I don't believe in that. I don't want to have Alzheimer's and live to an old age in an old people's home. I want to die young, like, what was that, Jim Morrison of The Doors, live fast, die young. And I don't want to talk about your Buddhism. I want to talk about politics, because that's more important. And I don't want to sit at the front on the veranda like you like sitting. I want to sit in the corner where we're not disturbed. And we're not going to have your biscuits. We're going to have a muffin, a chocolate muffin, because that's what I like, and you're going to have one too. And we're going to sit there for 1.5 hours, because that's all the time I have, not less than that, not more than that, okay? And if you got a call like that, what would you do? And the standard response is you'll find some excuse, any excuse, to get away from such a control freak. I've got to go to the dentist. I just remembered. Oh, it slipped my mind. I've got an appointment. Sorry, try next time. Because no one would like to go to a place where you're told what to eat, what to talk about, how long for, where to sit and everything else. Would you? But imagine that someone called you up and said, could you like to come out for a cup of coffee? He said, oh, I'm so sorry, I've got a dentist appointment. Oh, it's a shame, because you were talking about this coffee house in the back of Singapore somewhere. I remember once when I was staying at Wat Ananda in Singapore, and no one actually brought me any breakfast. And I was really hungry, and this Thai man eventually found me. And he said, I'm not giving you any breakfast. I said, no, I'm hungry. He said, come with me. And he took me to this coffee shop. And I don't know where it is, in the back of Singapore somewhere. And it was the most delicious coffee I've ever tasted. It really was really good stuff. It's just, you know, where the taxi drivers and other people eat. And it was fantastic. I don't know where it was. It's a big shame. But, you know, there are some coffee shops which are really nice. And so they say, that coffee shop you keep talking about, I know where it is. Let's go there. And I'd say, oh, no, I'll cancel the appointment. And they say, you know, I'm always interested in your Buddhism business because, you know, so let's talk about what you want to talk about. Now, I know you sort of always like muffins, chocolate muffins. Really, chocolate muffins. I want to try it because you say it's so wonderful. And we can sit where you want to sit, however long you want to sit there for. Someone like that, of course you like hanging out with them. And you go out there, you cancel your dentist appointment, and you end up being there 3 or 4 hours and being late home because you have a good time with such people who don't try and control you, but are interested in what you're interested in. Now, do you get the understanding? That in your meditation, if you try and control your mind, say, mind, you have to watch your breath. You have to watch your breath this way, not the way you want to. You've got to watch it at the tip of the nose. But the breath said, I'm not going through the tip of the nose. I'm going through the mouth. I'm going through somewhere else. No, tip of the nose. And you're going to sit there for 1 hour. You know, not your half an hour business. We're serious. 1 hour you're going to sit there. And you're not going to think about the stuff you like thinking about. We're going to think about Dhamma, nothing else. Insight, okay? No wonder that when you try and meditate, your mind thinks, oh, I've got an appointment. Sorry, I can't come. Anything to get away from you. And that's a very accurate simile of why people get restless. It's because you don't love your mind. You haven't given it loving kindness, metta. Which means as soon as the mind sees you coming, God, not her again, will run away and hide anywhere. If not in thoughts and fantasies, past and future, he'll run away in sloth and torpor. At least she can't find me there. So if you're kind to the mind, give it a break. Stop trying to control it so much. Be soft with it. If it wants to think, go off and think. Mind, if you want to fall asleep, fine by me. Just fall asleep. It's natural. So then you find meditation works. You're overcoming a couple of obstacles there. Sloth and torpor, restlessness, ill will, just with this beautiful loving kindness. And you can't go wrong with opening the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now. You find lots of peace, lots of happiness, and the mind becomes still all by itself. So these are the ways of overcoming the hindrances. The last one, oh, I've got 5 minutes, which is good, is the simile of the prison. Because I spent a lot of time in prisons, and once when one of the monks was going to a prison, this was in Casuarina jail, if anyone knows that jail, the prisoners invited him to stay for a cup of tea afterwards. And as they were talking with him, they asked, what's it like in a Buddhist monastery? And when he told them, our schedule, they soon realized Bodhinyana Monastery is far more austere and ascetic than a prison in Australia. In a prison they got TVs, they got soft beds, you don't have to sleep on the floor, they have 3 meals a day, actually 4 meals a day. And you can watch videos and play tennis and goodness knows what other sports. In prisons, prisons in Australia are far more comfortable than Bodhinyana Monastery, which is one of the reasons monks aren't afraid at all of going to jail. It'll be like a 5-star holiday compared to Bodhinyana Monastery. And if ever we want to have a retreat, we just punch a prison officer, we get 3 months solitary. Yes! But one of the prisoners, having heard what it's like at Bodhinyana Monastery, was actually so surprised, and they liked the monk. So they actually said to him, that's so terrible in your monastery, why don't you come and stay with us instead? He said, not realizing what he said, until everyone burst out laughing. But it made me think, what is the difference between Bodhinyana Monastery and a prison? The only difference is, in a prison, you don't want to be there. Doesn't matter how comfortable it is. If they give you butler service, if you have, was it Foxtel with 49 TV channels or however many it is, and if you have gourmet food and the best beds, if you don't want to be there, it's called prison. Doesn't matter how austere it is. If you want to be here, you're free. And that was such an insight into the difference between prison and freedom. and realizing there's so many prisons that we make in our life. You may be in Jhana Grove, you don't want to be here. And this is now a prison for you. As I say, you may be in a job you hate, which means your job is a prison. You may be in an old body which is getting sick and dying. I don't want to be in this body. Now your body is a prison for you. Or in a meditation and it's not going well. Your meditation becomes your prison. And it's very easy to escape from the prisons you make in life. Not by jumping over the walls. Not by changing your meditation and making it just blissful or whatever. Not by changing your job. By changing your attitude from I don't want to be here to I want to be here. No matter where you are. So you may have a very sick and painful body. If you say I don't want to be here, you're in prison. If in your sick and painful body you say I want to be here, then you're free as a bird. If you have a very difficult meditation, it's hurting, it's tired, bored, frustrated, you're in a prison until you say, I want to be here. I want to be frustrated. I want to be tired. I want to be depressed. Then you are free, like a bird again. It's so easy to be free if you want to be here, wherever that happens to be. So, whatever hindrance it is, just remember, if you want to be somewhere else, you've just made a prison. However you're experiencing, tired, restless, if you say to this, I want to be here. This is where I am. I want to be here. Then you find this incredible freedom. That's the freedom which takes you to jhana and nibbana. Wanting to be here. All suffering is wanting to be somewhere else. Understand? So meditation's easy. You just have to want to be here. You're here anyway, so you might as well want to be here. Okay, any questions or comments on hindrances? Great, so you're all free of hindrances now. So this afternoon jhana, what day is it today? Sunday, Monday stream winning, Tuesday once returning, Wednesday, what's Wednesday non-returning, Thursday arahat, Friday psychic powers, and Saturday you don't need to go on an aircraft, you can just fly by yourself back to Singapore. All planned out. Okay, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Where's the teddy bear today?